to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties, bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We'll discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send us an email or favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the last five are archived on our website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. Now this time we're going to be talking about mentoring and not only how to be a good mentor, but how to, what you look for to find yourself a mentor, because you know, no matter how long we've been in business or how experienced we are, there's always someone who knows more than we do and someone we respect who we'd like to have as our mentor. Yeah, that's always good. I have had many mentors in my professional and in my life. And I'm sure that you have too. So let's get started. And just like we sometimes do, let's define what we're talking about in this context. How shall we define the term mentor? What is that? Who is that? And I see we have lots of participation. Thank you all very much for being here. And let's see. You know, this is a very lovely definition. And a lot of people are saying basically the same thing. Anne says that a mentor is someone with experience who is willing to share. Oh, that's wonderful. Someone with experience who is willing to share. And that's really the key to mentoring, isn't it? It's sharing knowledge. Yeah. Someone with experience who is willing to share. Because a lot of people have experience, but, well, they kind of keep it to themselves. We need somebody to share it with us. As we will share our experience with others, right? Daniel and others are using the word teacher, a teacher who gives instruction. You know, I have quite a few people, this is actually lovely because it means that you've had good experiences. A lot of people using the word teacher, a lot of people using the word supervisor, like at work, a supervisor, somebody who is your superior, people using the word superior. And a lot of people are saying their parents were wonderful mentors, which is marvelous because that's, of course, your first mentor is your parents. They have more experience and they're willing to share. Yes, they want to teach you and give you the value of their experience, yeah, to show you what they know and how you can use it. Someone who Mashiko says that a mentor is someone who takes an interest in you. Someone who takes an interest in you. Right. We're getting a lot of agreement about these definitions. Thank you for all your participation. Brogan and others are saying it's a person who has gained success and wishes to help the next generation. Yes. A person who has gained success and wishes to help the next generation. And that's not just your parents, right? Oftentimes, that's people in a profession. People are using technology as an example where you build on other people's imaginative solutions, and then they mentor other people, and they help the next generation. And then everybody benefits by the new thoughts, the new ideas. A person who has gained success and wishes to help the next generation. It doesn't necessarily have to be the next generation in the sense of, in the sense of family. The next generation in the sense of those who come behind, who are going to be, well, in that line of work or in that line of helping other people. Yeah, the next generation. Sip of water there. So, now that we have a very nice definition of who's a mentor, what a mentor is. And we decided that they are really fine people who have experience and are willing to share and want to help the next generation and take an interest in you and give you instruction. So what do we look for when we are seeking a mentor? What do we look for? What should be our guiding principles? We'd like someone to mentor us. We're going into a new field. We are going on to the next step. We are entering into some sort of a area where we haven't had a lot of experience. And even if we have had a lot of experience, we want to know what other people think. We'd like someone to mentor us. So what do we look for when we are seeking a mentor? You know, this is an interesting point. We've got quite a few, bit of agreement on this first idea. Lee and others are saying that when you're trying to find a mentor, you try to find someone with different experience so that we can learn. Not someone who knows really kind of what you know, but someone with different experience so that we can learn from them. And there's a lot of agreements. A lot of people basically said the same thing, a different experience so that we can learn from them. Someone who has a different perspective even. Someone who is in some way not exactly in the same area that we are, but it would be interesting to have their input. Cecilia says that it's someone with similar experiences so they can chart a course of action. Chart a course of action. Well, all right, we're getting some agreement, but we're also getting some disagreement with the concept of chart a course of action, because it is a good point that your mentor can't do it for you, right? That's not the idea. We're not hiring an expert to do it for us, whatever it is. The mentor is supposed to use their experience, their knowledge, and their third-partiness. They can back up and see what's going on to help us understand how to go forward on our own. Not just tell us what to do, but show us what to do. Tell us why. So chart of course of action is not necessarily just, this is what you will do. I've written it down for you. But this is, let's talk about this and get the ideas and get to the right people type course of action. Because we want to learn. You know, this is an interesting point too, and yes, I do so agree. Ron and others are saying that when you're looking for a mentor, you need someone with a sincere interest in you and not just an assignment. You ever had that, especially in business? But even in clubs and education, all kinds of things, you kind of get assigned a more experienced member to either shadow, people are calling it shadow, but also to kind of be your buddy system. You know, that may be an Americanism, and of course this is a global show, but kind of the person that holds your hand when you're new. But they have no interest in you, right? You know, people are making quite a good, but a lot of people are making the point that not only do they not have an interest in you, but one needs to be cognizant of the fact that you were just assigned to them a faceless name on a list, so to speak, of newbies, for example. And you're assigned, we'll call them a mentor, but we don't really mean it. Your assigned mentor might actually have a motive to not help you, not only not have a sincere interest in you, but might feel threatened in some way, have their job threatened. Yeah, and you have to take that into account and have to think about it. How did I get you? Yeah. The best mentors, of course, are those who come kind of organically, yeah, that you are friends, you are acquaintances, they need you on a project, whatever, but it is a symbiotic relationship. And it flows from a natural interest in doing it right. Yeah, people are calling them assignment buddies. Yeah, a lot of times there's some sort of a committee or some sort of a group of experience, somebody who's retiring and you're taking their job. They might not all be all that pleased with you. Yeah, see, yeah. Yes, we're getting a lot of examples. Thank you for all of your participation. We're getting a lot of examples of less than stellar performance by a mentor who did not choose to be a mentor. That's the trick. Mentors really, they have to want to help you. They have to be, they basically have to be volunteers. Now, they might get, it might be a paid position that they're in that leads to their mentoring. People are calling them an ombudsman. Okay. Yeah, I tend to agree that an ombudsman to me is more of a person that everybody takes their complaints to and tries to resolve them. But maybe that's kind of a narrow definition. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it needs to be a sincere interest and not just an assignment. Mm-hmm. Jamie says, and others are saying this too, and thank you all for participation, that a mentor that you're looking for, if you're looking to find one, the question was, what do we look for when we are seeking a mentor? Jamie says, someone to work closely with on a regular basis. Because if you're not going to see them kind of regularly, they're not going to be able to give you advice. They're not going to be able to mentor you appropriately. Yeah. Well, all right, people are saying that you can do it by computer. That's still meeting on a regular basis, though. I don't necessarily think that in this day and age that one needs to literally be sitting across from each other at a table having a cup of coffee in order to have a regular basis. I think that Skype is certainly a regular basis. Maybe even email, the telephone. Yeah. You can talk on a regular basis. You don't have to actually see each other physically. Mm-hmm. Linda and others are saying not only do you need to be able to meet on a regular basis, but you need that the mentor needs to be available for questions. Mm-hmm. Needs to be able to take your call. Needs to be willing to talk to you. You need to have a way of finding him or her to ask for advice. Available for questions. And George is saying that not only available for questions, but they answer the questions promptly and clearly. Promptly and clearly. Yes, you understand what it is that they're telling you. They've made it clear. And they've done it within, sometimes questions expire, right? You need to know something about a decision and need to seek an opinion about a decision, and you can't wait for 2 months. You might not be able to wait for 2 days. They need to answer questions promptly and clearly. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are basically saying what Vicki is saying here. And I think that's true, especially in bigger companies, but even in smaller ones too. She says that you need to find a mentor as a guide through the corporate maze to show you the protocol of corporate culture. Your mentor should be a guide through the corporate maze and show you the protocol of, and help you with the protocol of corporate culture. Getting a lot of agreement about that. They've been in the company a long time. They know everybody. They know who's on what committee if it's a big enough company. They know who to go to when you need something. Guide through the corporate maze. You don't even have to be a corporation. You don't even have to be big to have one of those. It means that they know how to navigate with the various people. They've dealt with them before. They know who's who. They know who has what area. Mm-hmm. They act as your guide. I do like the word guide when you talk about mentoring because it means that I am helping you to find the answer for yourself and not that I am creating another me. I am giving you what I think is the answer for you to implement. No, I want you to come to, I want you to reason it out. I want you to think about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, guide through the corporate maze. Sometimes that's necessary so that you don't accidentally step on toes. Mm-hmm. Don't accidentally go make someone angry that you didn't understand you were supposed to talk to. Yeah, corporate maze, especially in a bigger, older business that has quite a few employees and a real corporate culture, a real way of doing things that they've always done it that way, and a real way of protocol, who to ask in this situation, who to inquire the advice of, who's in charge of that, how to, you know what I mean? It's a navigational thing to guide through the corporate maze. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mao says that you need to be an astute, your mentor needs to be an astute politician who understands the workplace. That's the corporate maze, perfectly put. An astute politician who understands the workplace. Mm-hmm. This is a good point. Dalma is saying that, and thank you for all your participation, Dalma is saying that in order to be a good mentor and to be good with the corporate maze and the culture, they need to be your ally in workplace disputes. Yeah, you need an ally sometimes. Sometimes workplaces are more competitive, we'll call it, than others, and you need someone in your corner. Someone who says, no, I think they did it right, or maybe it didn't exactly work out very well, to be able to negotiate not being let go, for example, mm-hmm. because they're your mentor and they're your ally in a workplace dispute. Hmm. Yeah, that's very valuable ally if they can keep your job, right? Yeah. So, now we've talked about who is a mentor, and we've talked what they do, and we've talked about what we look for in a mentor. But most of us, I would venture to guess, since we are usually the leaders of the negotiation, the seminar, the workshop, the alternative dispute resolution, since we're usually in the leadership role, we've probably been around a while, and we have some experience, and we're good at it. We're respected in the community, and someone will want us as a mentor. And because we are fine people, we will, of course, accept the role as mentor because we have experience and we are willing to share. But what do we do when we are the mentor? And really, how does that work? It may be our first time being a mentor and we never thought about it. We've had mentors in our careers, in our lives, but now someone has respected us and has asked us to be a mentor. What should we do? How should we act? Mm-hmm. This is an excellent point that quite a few of you are making, and it really does make a difference. And I must confess, I guess, like everything else, this is an organic show. I always say that because it's led by your responses and your questions, and thank you all for being there. But I suppose I think this is a great response because I think it's so important, right? Well, you know, it's kind of like I'm the mentor and I color my opinions by my experiences. But Stephen and others are saying that when we are the mentor, we need to personally select the mentee so that our personalities will be a good fit. There's no sense in having a mentee who argues with you all the time. You're not forcing them to follow your advice, but what do you want them to argue with you? And then maybe say something about you to someone else that you're wrong. No, that means your personalities are a bad fit. They're not a good mentee. You want them to listen, and you want them to consider. You don't necessarily, they don't have to comply. This is not some sort of a regulation, a rule, a law. But you want them to respect your opinion. They've asked you to be their mentor. You need to personally select them and not just get them off a piece of paper. Because quite frankly, just like we talked about when you have a mentor or we have a mentor and you're just an assigned person because they have more experience and you're new, for example, they're not going to take it real sincerely, right? Unless they get to know you and then, you know, you form the personal relationship. But the same thing about your mentees. Well, you need to select them. Yeah. And no, this is not, people are saying that you don't select them, you don't select your mentees when you're in like a volunteer teaching situation, I'm going to call it, like a, where you're tutoring someone. Being a tutor and being a mentor are two completely different things. Tutoring is when you're teaching someone, for example, like reading or something to disadvantaged high school students. That is, you're teaching someone a skill, straight out. You're teaching them some sort of a workshop. I work with Goodwill a lot, and they teach actual skills. But mentoring is like counseling, right? To help people use their skills in a way that is advantageous to all concerned. Yeah. So that's mentoring is not just teaching someone a skill. It is, well, yeah, people are saying it's teaching them how to work with the skill. But not technically like with your hands, but more how to deal in the workplace, how to deal in the social venue, whatever it is that we're talking about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, personally selects the mentee so the personalities will be a good fit. I think it's important. Mm-hmm. Angela and others are pointing out that in order to be a good mentor, what should we do? A lot of people are saying that you should be honest. As Angela says, be honest in your opinions. Yes, I think that's very important. And if you've got the right relationship with your mentee, they will understand that even if they do not like what they're hearing, it is an honest opinion born of experience. Just praising someone is not being a good mentor. They need to know what it is that needs improvement. Need to be honest in your opinions. But yeah, but not. An interesting point is being made that, thank you for all of your participation, that it is, when you're honest in your opinions, you can't be insulted if people don't take your advice. Well, and that's under the category of, I think they'll learn on their own, right? Yeah. Suki also has a very good point that when you are the mentor, you're kind of the leader, right? Because you just naturally are. You've got the experience, and you are helping someone else. And Suki says, if the relationship isn't working, we should say so. What a good thing. If the relationship isn't working, we should say so. And not just, I don't know, ignore it, not answer phone calls, back away. If the relationship isn't working, we should say so. And George and others are adding, find the person a new mentor. It isn't working. Our personalities don't fit. Mm-hmm. Maybe our schedules don't fit. You know, sometimes that happens too. I'm always in different time zones. And sometimes the schedule just doesn't fit. I can't answer your call at my 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm sleeping. You know what I mean? If my 3 o'clock in the morning is your, what would it be, 9 o'clock, even more so of a difference, you're 1 in the afternoon of the next day, well, you got to take that in consideration. Our schedules don't fit because you can't call me in the middle of my night. You got to call me at a reasonable hour on my time. And if that's not a reasonable hour at your time, well, our schedules don't fit. Yeah. If the relationship isn't working, we should say so. Yeah, I must confess I did once have a mentee like that. He never could figure out the time zone changes and that he was calling me at an abysmal hour, but it was a good hour for him. that relationship didn't work, and I said so. Yeah. Howard and others are saying that the main thing we should do when we are the mentor is to keep private confidences private. Yeah, don't squeal. Keep private confidences private. Because if your mentee cannot admit that they don't know something because you will go and tell their supervisor that they are dumb, well, that's not fair because they're supposed to be able to tell you when they're in trouble and ask for your advice. That's the whole idea of the thing. If they didn't need mentoring, we wouldn't have the relationship of mentor-mentee because they'd be the mentor. They'd be the smart one. Yeah. So, important to keep confidences. Pratima says you need to be available and you should set clear guidelines on call times and frequencies. That's a good response to my little mentee who didn't quite do that. And yes, sometimes you can set clear guidelines and they forget it. Be available, but set clear guidelines on call times and frequency. Mm-hmm. After all, we have things to do also. I like to try to set a time limit for calls too, because unless someone's really in emergency, and you know in my line of work there's not, I suppose there are emergencies, there's business emergencies, but nobody's bleeding or something. I mean, it's not like we're emergency room doctors and somebody has to run over right away or the patient's going to die. I do business law. I do business mediation and negotiation, and it's very important, of course, but I really encourage. Now, if they have an emergency, I suppose, but I really, really, really encourage, and this goes to personality fit, right? I encourage the people that I am mentoring to make an appointment with me so that I'm available and I'm not rushing out the door and they're not interrupting an important meeting and I've got some time to really listen to it. I'd like them to make an appointment. I'd like them to ask for some of my time because my time is what, you can't get that back. And I can't always answer on the spur of the moment either. I like them to give me an idea of what we're going to talk about so I can think on it and make an appointment. Mm-hmm. And I will try to make an appointment soon. I mean, it's not a way to delay the process and make people go, well, in 7 weeks we'll be talking. That's too long. But within the next few days, let's pick a time that's convenient to both of us. Mm-hmm. Like Pratima says, be available, but set clear guidelines on call times and frequency. Mm-hmm. And this goes to our prior statement that you should tell people if it's not working out. Mm-hmm. You know, Curtis says that it's good to have regularly scheduled meetings for questions and advice, especially when people are kind of new. Mm-hmm. When the mentee becomes more experienced, they don't really need to have a regular hand-holding session. But when people are new, as Curtis says, a regularly scheduled meetings for questions and advice, try to do that. Mm-hmm. Like maybe once a month. How's it going? Tell me, you know, what you're doing. How is it? And this is a really good thing. Some of you do this in groups. Well, I'm going to say the famous sentence that all of you say, I say all the time. I'm going to say it depends. I see quite a few people are saying that what they do is when they are mentoring, especially, classroom full of people, some kind of a group of people that are similar in age and in level and in need, that they actually have a regularly scheduled kind of a group mentoring session, like a group class. It doesn't seem like a bad idea to me. It depends who it is you're mentoring and whether or not they need to be private, a private confidence, or a group session would be really helpful. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, this is a good point. I don't usually do group mentoring sessions. I believe I call those my mediations and alternative dispute resolutions and like that. I guess those are kind of group mentoring sessions in its way. But I know what you mean, the actual teaching of from experience. Yeah, I don't usually do it. I guess I don't think about it in that way. I guess I do it all the time because of the seminars and the workshops. But if it's appropriate and you've got quite a few people, why not? Why not say the second Tuesday of the month, we're going to get together at this spot at this time. There's going to be some food. And we're going to discuss how we're doing openly and frankly. Mm-hmm. And you know what? A lot of people are saying that that's actually the best way of doing it because you get everybody's opinion. You're all both mentor and mentee. Mm-hmm. You learn what other people are doing. And you go, wow, I didn't think about that. Really? Cool. Yeah, I think that sounds like a wonderful idea. I just don't usually mentor groups like that, but I can see that that's an excellent idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that you learn from everybody, and you can be both mentor and mentee at the same time. Yay. And that would indeed be at regularly scheduled meetings for questions and advice. And you might even pose a question in advance to the group or have them send their questions in like by email first so that we can all think on it. What a good idea. Mm-hmm. Jennifer and others are saying that in order to be a mentor, you need to define expectations that you will teach, but not just clear the path. Define expectations when you starting a mentor-mentee relationship. Define expectations that you will teach, but not just clear the path. Yeah, that you're not just going to do it for somebody. That's not your job. That you're going to teach them how to do it. A lot of people are using the fish parable. I don't know. I suppose it translates well. It's kind of like I'm always cognizant of the fact that this is a global show, and thank you all for being here. And some of these things are kind of Americanisms because I happen to be an American. And you hear the little story that if you give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day, but teach a man to fish and he'll eat for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. Give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. Teach a man to fish, he'll eat for the rest of his life. Well, that's what this is. If you just do it for somebody, whatever it is, to help them and just clear the path, as Jennifer says, they'll never learn how to do it, and they'll always need you to come back and help them make it right, whatever it is that's gone kind of not so wonderful. No good. You haven't taught them to fish. You've just given them the fish. They'll eat for the day, but they won't be able to handle it next time it comes up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. David says the main thing that a mentor can do for their mentee is to introduce the younger person, more inexperienced person, introduce the mentee to additional people who can be of assistance. Yeah, what a good point. A lot of times, one of the best things we can do for somebody is steer them in the right direction. Go and talk to this person. They really know how to handle that. Mm-hmm. Steer them in the right direction. Introduce them to additional people who can be of assistance. And then they will have a relationship with this person, these additional people. And then You know, you don't keep, you stay friends. You stay acquainted and like that. For heaven's sakes, I mentored people 20 years ago who are still friendly with me and keep in touch and like that. But, you know, it's a process like everything else. You don't necessarily need to be mentored by the same person forever. You learn what there is to learn. They have taught you to fish, and you go forward, right? Yeah. I mean, you're still friends with the person, but you get introduced to new people who can help you now and be a new mentor and go forward and join your circle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you need to introduce your mentee to additional people who can be of assistance. You know, this is really, everybody's pretty much saying this, and the word is listen. Jackson says the most important thing you can do for your mentee is to listen. Listen to the mentee. And also it's being pointed out that you need to listen to those interacting with your mentee so you can see how they're doing. Because, you know, a lot of times if we knew what it was that we were doing, well, I hate to use the word wrong, but kind of not so successfully, and it was not going over very well, and we need advice, if we knew what it was that we were doing that the supervisor, whoever, doesn't like, we wouldn't do it. But we don't know what it is. We don't know how to make it better because we don't understand what it is that's needed, right? And that's the whole thing. You just, that's where the mentor comes in. And you need to listen not just to the mentee because they're telling you their side of it, basically speaking, right? It's like everything else. It's colored by their opinion of what's happening. But you need to listen to what other people who interact with the mentee are saying so that you can get an idea of how it's going. Because a lot of times, sincerely, the mentee has no idea how it's going. They really don't. If they didn't think they were doing it good, they wouldn't be doing it that way. Excuse me. So you have to talk to other mentors, their supervisors, the other people who are interacting with them to see their opinion too so that you can bring it forward to the mentee and give them advice that's based on a variety of opinions. Mm-hmm. Because the mentee can't tell you. If they could tell you, they would be the mentor. That's really the truth. So, we have, and listen is, of course, the most important. Listen to what people are saying. Listen to what your mentee is saying. And one of the best ways to listen, of course, is to, yes, thank you, is to network. And that's one of the reasons that Recipe for Peace Now, one of the few things we really insist on and advocate, is that when you're going to get people together in a mentoring session, in a negotiation, a workshop, a seminar, an alternative dispute resolution, whatever it is you're getting together for in order to give advice and to make a good decision as to the path that we're going to take, yes? It's always good to have some food because there'll be a time when and you need a timeout. You need to think. You need to just regroup. You need to know something about each other so that we can get along better and find something in common. And the way to do that is to actually see each other in a non-stressful, non-structured manner. And that's why we have a timeout with some food. That's what the potluck is for. And whenever, yes, I am indeed, I'm going to say exactly the same thing that I say every single show. And thank you all for being here, and thank you for coming back, because a lot of you know this. I say it every show because it's so important. The food is really just a tool, right, to get us talking to each other. It's a pleasant way. Look, what is that? That's delicious. How did you make it? It's a pleasant way to be on a topic that cannot be offensive to anyone. But we need to, I mean, it might be dinner, but it's really just a tool because it's not because we're hungry. It's because we want to know each other better, right? Right. And if you're going to have food, you want to have a convivial good time. So you need to make a survey as to whether or not anyone has a food prohibition, religious or otherwise, a food allergy, or they just don't eat that kind of food. You don't want anyone to have a bad time or, God forbid, get sick. Mm-hmm. So we're going to take a survey. We're going to send it to everybody so that everybody knows what we can't bring, who has a prohibition or an allergy. Now, when we bring the food, we ask everyone, please, to label it. Not what is it, meatloaf. No, what is in it? So that we can run our eye down the list of ingredients and see if there's something in there that we can't eat. Very important. Also, I know it's because I just hate to run out of food because I'm a good hostess. And usually we as the leader are the host. But, well, even if it's not our venue, we tend to be putting it together. I think it's very important to bring some extra food just so that we don't run out and it doesn't become a bad party, right? And because people have different ideas of what constitutes the right amount to bring. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to have to skimp. And since we're talking about what we're bringing, I think you should also have a safe recipe. Now, what's a safe recipe? A safe recipe is something that we've taken the survey, everybody can eat, doesn't have too many ingredients, and the ingredients that are listed would be something that my people would have eaten in the past and know if they can eat it. They'd be familiar with it. So that's a safe recipe. Now let's do the safe recipe where I see that we're running not so heavily on time. We don't have too much time left. Let's do our safe recipe this time. It's a cauliflower and pasta bake. Now it's got cheese. And it's got egg and like that and gluten. So you have to know how you're doing. But this is basically a vegetarian, not a vegan recipe. And it is very delicious and it's easily portioned out. People can just take a spoonful of it. And also you can make it in advance, bring it and warm it up if you've got the facilities. Or you can pack it down kind of tightly with aluminum foil or in one of those thermal covering type things, and bring it with you. It travels quite well. Here we go. It's a cauliflower and pasta bake, and it's got a bread topping. People tell me it's kind of a cross between it is really delicious. If you leave the bread topping off, you certainly could. I just like it because it makes kind of a little crunchy crust on the top with the cheese, and it's pretty, and it kind of adds texture to the thing. Okay. So here we go, cauliflower and pasta bake. It's kind of with a bread topping. I guess they're like croutons, kind of big croutons. So let's have a pound of pasta, which we're going to cook al dente and drain. Do not, please, and I know those who have been here before have heard me say this, don't use a long, thin pasta like a fettuccine. You know why? It's messy. When you go to dish it out, when people go to take it, you got to use tongs. It's just a mess. If you use a kind of pasta that you can dish out in a big spoon, you'll be happier, like a rotini or a penne or something like that. So a whole pound of it, going to cook it up, going to drain it, put it to the side. Let's have a couple pounds of cauliflower, just the florets, the little tops. Oh, I suppose you can cut the bottoms into it too, but you better make them smaller because we want to be able to have this be nice and yummy and soft and be capable of being dished out in a big spoon with the pasta and the croutons and the florets and like that, yeah. So I'm going to use frozen, let's face it. It is easy for me to find. It is inexpensive for me. If you're going to do like I do and use frozen, do defrost and thaw. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a couple tablespoons of oil. Let's have a nice big onion that we're going to chop up. I always prefer a sweet onion. It's just my preference. I think it is more delicious. I know that we're going to put it in the oil and everything, but still, I just, those big bitter ones, sometimes they never lose their bitterness. 3 garlic cloves, which is going to finely chop. You think that's too much garlic? People say I use a lot of garlic. I do. Put a less in there, put one in. Let's have about 3 nice big pats of butter. What is that, about an ounce each? A third of a cup of all-purpose flour, just for making the roux, for thickening. And let's have 4 cups of half and half. You can use cream, but do not use less than half and half. Don't use the thin stuff. I know it's fattening, but use it anyway, because otherwise it will just not have a nice texture. So we're going to use half and half. It's a big concession on my part, let's face it, because usually I would use cream. But, well, you know, it's not getting any thinner. So let's use 4 cups of half and half. Some nice shredded basil, like half a cup maybe, like a big handful. It looks nice. It tastes delicious. Mm-hmm. And let's do 2 cups of grated Parmesan cheese. It comes grated where I am, and which is a very fine thing. If not, give it kind of a medium grate, because we want it to be on the top and also inside. Pardon me. Okay, let's talk about the bread topping. This is kind of optional, but it does make a lovely crust to it, and it's pretty. So if you get about 6 slices of not so terribly soft bread, like white bread, and cut it into large, I usually crust it just because it makes it more even, and you cut it into like big cubes, and we're going to get another couple of pats of butter that we're going to melt, because we're going to dip it in the butter and then put it on the top of the casserole is almost like a crust, and then put the cheese on top of that. Yeah. So about 6 slices. Use your judgment. They have to be pretty thick slices so you can cut them into cubes. Mm-hmm. That kind of dense, like sourdough bread type dense. I prefer plain. Yes, people are asking about all kinds of bread. Yes, anything, any kind of bread will do. I'm not fond of the bitter ones, but that's just me. People asking things about rye bread and things. Yes, the answer is yes, as long as it's firm enough to make cubes and make like croutons. But of course, if you're going to have seeds and stuff, you have to inquire as to your guests, as to the people who are going to eat it, mm-hmm. Participants. Let's preheat the oven to 350. We've cooked our pasta, right? It's sitting to the side. Now we're going to cook our cauliflower. We're going to steam it. Just give it a nice steam until it's just edible, just tender. Because we're going to bake it, but if you don't steam it first, the darn thing will be hard as a rock. It really will. So steam it. I don't know what you call it when you steam vegetables, not very softly, al dente. Steam it so that it's nice and tender, but not soft, because otherwise it'll fall apart. So we've got, and put it aside. So we've got the pasta cooked, we've got the cauliflower cooked. We're going to heat the oil in a nice big pan, we're going to add the onion and the garlic. We're going to squish it all around until the onion is soft, and it smells fantastic. And what, about 3 minutes? And we're going to put that now, we're going to take a slotted spoon so we don't do it with all the oil, and we're going to put that right on the cauliflower, mix it in. Mm-hmm. Might as well, because we're going to get it out of the pan. So now we're going to take our butter, mm-hmm. and we're going to melt that in it. And, well, let's think about this. I usually use the same pan, but I do get the oil out of it. I kind of use the spoon and get the oil out of it onto the cauliflower. So we're going to melt the butter, and we're going to blend in the flour. And we're going to stir it all around for about a minute, yeah, so that it's not lumpy and it's all incorporated. And you can't stop stirring for the minute, right, because otherwise you'll get lumps and it'll kind of stick. Now we've got the flour and the butter in the pan, right, kind of a biggish saucepan for this. And we're going to take a whisk and we're going to whisk in the half and half. Whisk, 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 stir it constantly until the whole thing boils and thickens. Yeah, I know it's a little bit of a pain to stand there and do it, but you can look at your phone with the other hand or something, because if you don't stand there and whisk it, it won't come out nice. It has to bring to a boil and thicken, and now take it off the heat. It's nice and hot and boiling. We're going to stir in the basil. Three-quarters of a cup of basil. I like basil. Depends how you feel about it. And we're going to stir in half of the Parmesan. Remember, we have 2 cups of Parmesan? Let's put a cup. Stir it all around. Add the cauliflower mixture and the pasta. Incorporate the whole thing, right? Yum, yum. And we're going to put that into a nice baking dish. I always grease a baking dish. I don't even know if you have to with this, but I always do it just out of habit. In all truth and honesty, in the States and in a lot of places, you know, you've got that spray cooking oil. Just give everything a spray when you go and bake it. I just do it naturally. I don't suppose you actually have to, but it's a good idea anyway. So we've mixed everything together, except the bread, right? And we are putting it in our nice big baking dish. Now we've got some melted butter that we have, the couple of pats that we save for the croutons, right, the bread. We're going to toss the breadcrumbs in the melted butter. We don't do anything else. Just toss them in. Give them a little toss in the pan. Yum, yum. And we're going to put them over the pasta mixture on the top. Not connected with each other or anything. It's just kind of scattering all over the top. We're going to take that nice cup of Parmesan cheese we have left over, sprinkle it over the bread topping and the noodle topping. Just sprinkle it over everything. Stick in the oven. Half an hour, maybe a little bit more. When everything's all bubbly and golden and like that and it just looks yummy, you're in. Safe recipe. It is a safe recipe because it has ingredients that everyone is familiar with, because we have taken our survey and no one cannot eat gluten or egg or cheese, dairy, and it doesn't have too many ingredients. And basically speaking, people are not incapable of eating it. And it's very lovely, and it can be dished out easily. So that's our safe recipe. Let's get down to our adventure recipe. What makes this an adventure recipe? The thing has shrimp in it. Lots of people don't eat seafood for one reason or another. You want to make this less of an adventure recipe, then you will use chicken, not pork. Chicken, or maybe more vegetables. You can make this vegetarian if you like. But it's a shrimp-fried brown rice. You can use white rice also. Quite frankly, I usually do. I just think it's more delicious, but that's just me. But a lot of people like brown rice because it has more nutrients. So let's have a couple tablespoons of oil. Let's take about 4 scallions and just diagonally slice them thinly, so that they're delicious and they look nice mixed in with the rice. 3 cloves of garlic that we're going to mince. Let's have a pound, depends how many people you've got coming, pound and a half of cooked rice. I actually own a rice cooker. It's one of the few things I own that only does that, but it's because I serve so much rice on the side. So make it according to the package directions. It has to be cooked, yeah. Let's have 3 tablespoons of soy sauce. Do you think that's a little salty? Make it 2 tablespoons of soy sauce. 2 large eggs that we're going to beat up, and we're actually going to scramble them because it makes the little pieces inside the rice delicious. Let's have 1.5 pounds of little shrimp. This is the only time I think that those little shrimp are a good thing. You know how I always say, and those of you who have been here before know that I always say, don't use the little squiggly ones because they don't have so much taste. For this, you can use small shrimp. because they're incorporated into the rice. I do like them to show, though, so that nobody makes the mistake of accidentally eating this and then finding out it has shrimp in it. That would be terrible. I've seen people do it with bigger shrimp that they cut into pieces and the darn thing looks like chicken. This is why we have everything labeled very clearly. Yeah, not a good thing. So we're going to use the little ones, and I always, just because I am very cognizant of this, I actually garnish this with some shrimp so that you can see that there's shrimp in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right on top. So we're going to have about a pound and a half of the shrimp. The little ones are just fine. Not the really squiggly ones, please. No, the ones that are just small, but not little things. I guess I just don't like those. Okay. You can use the little bitty ones if you think people will like it. So we're going to heat the oil, and we're going to add the scallions and the garlic and stir fry for about a minute. We're going to add the rice and stir it around. Then you can do this either way you want. I don't like to make too many pots is what it really is. The pot is nice, the skillet is nice and oily. You can use a wok if you own one. I don't actually own one. The skillet is nice and oily. So I actually scoot the rice to the side, and I take the scrambled eggs, the beaten eggs, and I put them to the side that nothing's on, and I scramble them real fast before they can get all over. Because what you're really making is scrambled eggs, and you're incorporating it into the rice and kind of blending it in. So you might as well just do it right in the same pan. So we're going to stir fry those until they're scrambled. You combine your now scrambled eggs with the rice. You add the soy sauce. If your shrimp are cold, if they are not cooked, because the little ones tend to come cooked around here. But if they are not cooked, you need to, of course, stir fry them. I would stir fry them ahead of time and have them cooked, and the little cooked shrimp are now incorporated in. I'm making a big fuss about cook because if you add the raw shrimp, that's not going to be a good thing. You need to cook the shrimp. Usually the little bitty ones come pre-cooked. At least they do around here. If they were frozen, you need to, of course, have defrosted and thawed. You mix it all in, all nice and hot. You make sure everything's incorporated, everything's hot, everything is cooked through. There you have it. It is our adventure recipe, really because of the shrimp, more so than anything else. Yes, use chicken. What I'm telling you is use cooked chicken, little cubed cooked chicken, not raw chicken. You need to cook it first. It's kind of a good recipe if you've also got leftover cooked chicken. I hate to say that, though, because I don't want you to accidentally serve something that is too leftover and is not safe to eat. So I don't like to use the word leftovers, but if I did use the word leftovers, I would say it's good for cooked chicken and cooked ham and things like that. Very delicious cooked pork. Also, those things would not make it safer, but vegetables and chicken would. So that is our adventure recipe. Very popular, easy to do, easy to rewarm. You need to bring it to rewarm it, and you've got the facilities. You can stir fry the protein and add it in, because you don't want it to kind of clump together as you're carrying it, as you're bringing it. And I see that our time together is nearly up. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you for listening. If you would like to contact us, we are at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. Website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. The last 5 shows are archived on our website, Recipe for Peace Now. All of the shows, including the last 5, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/Recipe for Peace Now. Thank you very much for your participation. I always learn something. I hope you do too. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.